A new book from the Dirksen Congressional Center in Pekin outlines how Donald Trump tried to reshape the Senate when he was president.
Part of that is Trump as disruptor, part of that is Trump as accelerant, but clearly all of the blame does not belong at his feet.
That story coming up on WGLT's Sound Ideas. Good evening, I'm John Norton. Also on today's show, ISU students show how they're encouraging their schoolmates to be more civically engaged.
They all can find something that they feel like benefits them, teaches them something, gets them involved in their community. There's something for everyone.
And the latest edition of McHistory explores McLean County's long history with softball. Stories follow a Bloomington Normal News update. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, part of the NPR network.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. Here My Story continues with local patients Ralph and Carol Weisite.
I do like the feature that allows you to adjust the direction that the sound is coming from. Really is helpful in just being able to have a good conversation with somebody.
Ralph and Carol's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
From the campus of Illinois State University in Normal, this is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas. Good evening, I'm John Norton. First up, we wanted to let you know the Unit 5 School Board will hear a report tonight that assesses the district's capacity needs and its demographic breakdowns by school. We'll take a deep dive into what the data shows and what it could mean on tomorrow's Sound Ideas. To say that Donald Trump was a president unlike any other isn't breaking news. Most either love or hate him, with very few somewhere in between. The Dirksen Congressional Center in Pekin has commissioned a new book entitled Disruption: The Senate During the Trump Era. It takes an academic look at how Trump changed the U.S. Senate during his 4 years in office. Tim Shelley from sister station WCBU has more.
By design, the U.S. Senate is kind of like an institutional bulwark resisting change. That's anathema to a disruptive leader like Trump, who as president needs Congress to accomplish much of his agenda.
And so these two extremes, putting them together and testing out this theory of the relationship between the presidency and the U.S. Senate under those circumstances seemed like a really important question to ask.
That's Tiffany White, executive director of the Dirksen Center. A coterie of 18 professionals in various fields contributed their takes on that relationship. That includes Dr. Sean Theriault, a professor at the University of Texas at Austin and author of Disruption. When Trump was elected back in 2020, the Senate was led by fellow Republican Mitch McConnell. Yet despite sharing many priorities, Theriault says the relationship did see its share of personality clashes.
When the goals were aligned, they got along hand in glove, and we can think of everything from Supreme Court nominations to reducing taxes. But then when it comes to other things, such as the tradition laid in Senate or the tradition laid in presidency, you saw them act very differently.
Judicial confirmations in particular are an area where Trump and the GOP-led Senate saw a high degree of cooperation in shifting the courts to the right. The appointments of three Supreme Court justices solidified the court's conservative majority, and that's not to mention a slew of appellate and district court judge appointments. Tiffany White says Senate historian emeritus Don Ritchie offers perspective in one chapter. He traces the push on the norms of the judicial nomination process back as far as the Clinton presidency.
It came to a crescendo during the Trump administration, but I really appreciate Don's perspective that he offers to readers about the circumstances that I think really created the groundwork for what we saw in between 2016 and 2020.
Sean Theriault notes increased polarization now leads government to essentially grind to a halt when the White House and the Congress are controlled by opposite parties. He says that's elevated the importance of the courts, which are now handing down decisions he says were unthinkable even a decade ago. That's enabled in part, he says, by the breakdown of the lawmaking process.
Part of that is Trump as disruptor, part of that is Trump as accelerant, but clearly all of the blame does not belong at his feet. We see the courts playing a much more prominent role, which means that when there are vacancies, the politics surrounding the filling of those vacancies takes on an even bigger role in determining national policy making.
Theriault acknowledges that taking a stab at an objective analysis of recent U.S. history is challenging. He says that's why the book pulls in not only historians, but also journalists, political scientists, former Senate staffers, and others.
Each of the different subfields brought a different perspective so that we could have a really nuanced picture of what disruption question mark was all about.
White says Dirksen Center's mission is educational, and the book doesn't really try to lead the reader to one particular conclusion on how President Trump impacted the Senate.
I think that regardless of a reader's bias coming into the book, whether they like Donald Trump or whether they don't like Donald Trump, I think that their preconceived notions will in some ways be challenged, but also in some ways be enhanced or supported.
For his part, Theriault says he's proud that disruption didn't wrap up with a neat conclusion or consensus on the complicated question the book poses.
What I think of is we provided lots of building blocks, but the building that the reader will assemble after reading this book, it could be very different just given what the things that they value.
Disruption question mark will be released on May 7th. It's published by Oxford University Press. I'm Tim Shelley.
Box office ticket sales are down, and yet movie theaters persist. How the architecture of said theaters has helped them stay afloat. Next time on Marketplace.
Listen to Marketplace beginning at 5:30 this afternoon on WGLT, sponsored by CEPFUEL.
How do we address the crisis of youth gun violence? One solution, keep the guns out of their reach. But some people say it may also help to train kids on how to handle guns responsibly.
I would rather raise a responsible generation of gun owners than a generation of gun owners that's never been exposed to the safety message.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Listen between 4 and 9 a.m. on 89.1 WGLT.
We take you next to where democracy stands on the Illinois State University campus. The spring semester is winding down, but before long, election season will soon start ramping up. And one group is hoping to help students become more involved ahead of the fall election. It's one where many young people are unhappy with both major party candidates for president. ISU Center for Civic Engagement. The group offers many volunteer and service opportunities, but one of those is directly tied to democracy. The group hosts voter information events and publishes an online voter guide. It helps students learn how to register to vote, learn about the candidates, and even learn the basics about how elections work. As part of WGLT's podcast series, Democracy's Future with a Vedette, reporter Mia Serres talks with two students heavily involved with the center. Allie High is a senior political science major from Bloomington, and Kareem Tezdan is a poli-sci and economics double major from Macomb in Western Illinois. They explain what first got them interested in politics and government, starting with Allie High.
When I came to ISU, I was a cybersecurity major. I was passionate about technology and how it impacts people and how it can benefit all of us. And I had the privilege of doing research on the benefits of AI technology and things of that nature. And it really got me focused on how this technology can be a bridge to increase access to resources for people, share information more broadly. Really, you know, it has its risks, of course, but it really can be in the right way used as a force of good. And so I pretty much shifted my focus in that respect to policy and, you know, community engagement sort of efforts and interests. And so that's how I ended up at the center.
Yeah, for me, I always grew up loving history. I would be like the kid in class, like through all the way through high school, like always trying to read like the history books. And it was awesome because they would never be checked out. So I always had first pick. And the coolest part to me about history is then how that plays into our modern day political climate and our modern day world. So as much as I still love history, I knew that when it came time to pick a plan of study for attending Illinois State, that I did want to choose political science and specifically learn about, initially it was the interest of how governments interact, right? So that was sort of the interest I had throughout history. How do countries interact with war, peace, trade, all that. But really, to me, what it all boiled down to for me as a major in political science is not just how countries or governments or political actors interact, but how do people interact?
Why is it important for students to engage with the center?
There are many connections to be made, whether it's through volunteering, attending one of the events, volunteering on election day to run one of the greeter stations, whether, you know, all students of every program, every skill set, every interest, they all can find something that they feel like benefits them, teaches them something, gets them involved in their community. There's something for everyone. And it's just a little building right across from Watterson that, you know, but they do really great work in our community, and they facilitate some great connections within the community between campus and, you know, the town of Normal, the city of Bloomington, McLean County. And so I think it's just important to check it out, even if you're not sure what you want to do or how you can get involved. Their website has some great information and also has events that they can attend.
Yeah, I just think the center is a whole lot of fun. The people are pretty amazing, and like Ali mentioned, it's quite diverse in its array of people of different majors, different backgrounds, who are doing different types of work, whether it's more socially involved work or volunteering, or more politically, like voter related. So it is really cool to see just so much overlap in one building, quite frankly.
How does the center's mission help uphold democracy?
I would say that civic engagement and voting efforts in particular are the foundation of our democratic process. And so providing that information to students and eligible voters is key to upholding these processes that we hold so dearly and strengthening them over time.
Yeah, so I'm even, as a part of my last semester here, taking a civic engagement course. I'm not a part of the civic engagement responsibility minor, but I just thought the course was really interesting. And one of the readings that was recently assigned to us was called Bowling Alone. Now, just based off the title initially, I thought, okay, well, bowling, I can't even get like a spare or a strike every time I go out bowling. But then upon actually reading the book, it did go into a lot of how, unfortunately, in American society, the trend has shifted away from going to a local, like, a community meeting to discuss like an issue, whether it's at the neighborhood level or at the city level. There's unfortunately been that sort of decline of that sort of involvement. And I think the Center for Civic Engagement is the ultimate counter to not caring about important issues.
What questions and concerns are you hearing from students about the election, and how do we go about addressing them?
I think one of my biggest goals going forward into the November general election is stressing the importance of the local races as much as the national races. These elections will be politically fraught, and we are mindful of that. But these representatives that we have the opportunity to vote in at the local level direct county funding. They support the social services we have in our community. And so getting students aware of these more nuanced that may not have as much attention as the more public races are is something that I will work hard to share with the students. And I think that that is something that will come up and is important to address. As far as more election structure things, I would say that the residency part is something that comes up pretty frequently. We do have a lot of students that are either registered in another county or have never registered in McLean County during their time here at ISU. And we, to the best of our ability, try to get that information to these individuals so they can register to vote regardless of whether they need to register in McLean County or vote back home.
For me, what I've noticed from a lot of students is trying to figure out where to direct, what avenue to direct any form of very strong disagreements or agreements with policy or change that they want. Voting is obviously a thing that we always, you know, like emphasize at the center. Alongside that, it is also issues of voter education, right? Learning more about the candidates and actually going to events where they might be present, and, you know, like a town hall, for example, and ask them the real questions. I think those are the sorts of things that we can do to try and help maybe alleviate some of the concerns of that many students understand we have of, well, I experience these issues every day. These are the challenges that I face as a citizen or as a non-citizen. Where do I sort of direct that?
It was ISU students Kareem Tasdan and Ali High speaking with Vedette reporter Mia Serres. You can hear more of their conversation on the podcast series Democracy's Future. You can subscribe on the NPR app or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up tomorrow on Sound Ideas, hear that McLean County's largest school district is studying its space needs as its student population grows. You'll hear from a consultant and their recommendation for Unit 5 on tomorrow's Sound Ideas. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT. I'm John Norton. Baseball is happening and all is right with the world. Today, though, let's hear about another bat and ball game, softball. As we hear in this episode of our WGLT series, Make History, it was big in Central Illinois for many decades with lots of semi-pro teams. It offered an outlet for many young women at a time there were few organized sports opportunities for females.
Carlock Comets, 1966. It is hard to go back to addressing a certain young lady as Miss Siebert. After having called her, way to go, Dottie, she can't bat, Dottie, you can do it, Dot, and it's all right, Dottie, all summer while she pitched for our women's ball games.
Central Illinois has a deep, really deep history when it comes to the national pastime, baseball. That's also true when it comes to the sport of softball.
Hi, my name is Julie Emig, and I'm the Executive Director of the McLean County Museum of History.
This is Bill Kemp, Librarian, McLean County Museum of History.
A game with Hayworth this Thursday evening and the homecoming game with the Peoria Clippers will just about wind up the season.
And the golden age of softball would be the 1930s, the Depression era, into the 1980s and early 1990s. At one time, it seemed like everybody was playing softball.
Miss Siebert is a perfect example of the old slogan, one pitcher's worth a thousand words.
And there were softball leagues organized by 4-H clubs. There was a softball league the Farm Bureau organized on a county basis. There was an industrial league in Bloomington Normal where large employers fielded a softball team. A little bit later on in the 1960s, you had a women's industrial league.
I think women's softball is very entertaining and I'm not being prejudiced, said Bloomington Bearcats coach Judy Johnson. If we could get some fans out there, I think they would enjoy themselves.
O'Neill Park on the west side of Bloomington became a mecca for both slow and fast pitch beginning in the 1950s and into the 1980s, and was really kind of a center in downstate Illinois for fast pitch softball when it came to some well-known semi-professional teams.
Coach Johnson of rural Towanda is the coach of the Bloomington Bearcats, a girls softball team. And she's not being prejudiced when she says there's something more to girls softball than, well, than just girls.
Dottie Siebert was a well-known women's softball player and PE teacher in Bloomington Normal in Atlanta, Illinois from the 1960s into the 1980s. For first the Carlock Comets and later the Bloomington Bearcats. Dottie was born in 1933 in Congerville, but she would graduate from Normal Community High School and then earn a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in physical education.
Why do women play softball? Is it just for enjoyment, or is it to gain some element of fame as the Pekin Letts have done? It's a little bit of both, replied Coach Johnson.
She's also leading the Girls Athletic Association. Before you had girls-sanctioned sports in high school, some high schools organized athletic associations, often led by a woman PE teacher, because young girls were just desperate, were hungry to play sports, and there were few outlets for them.
Some enjoy the skills involved in softball. It is the team sport of the summer. You look at teams from little towns like Hopedale and Clinton. They have enough backing to muster a team. Here, Bloomington girls have a chance to play organized softball, and it is organized. We don't mess around. Miss Johnson has mustered up a pretty good squad here in Bloomington. For pitchers, the Bearcats have Miss Dot Siebert of Normal and Miss Wilma Crabb of Pontiac. Miss Vicki Killis, an Illinois State University graduate this spring from Pontiac, is the catcher.
And then the Carlock Comets will merge with a women's softball team in Pontiac, the Indian Ets, to form the Bloomington Bearcats in 1969-1970.
During the first 2 years, the Bloomington team received little notoriety despite very respectable season records. But this year, the Bearcats are making big noise, and bigger and better things are coming their way. A most attractive schedule, which features between 40 and 50 games, including four tournaments and top-notch competition, is rapidly making the Bearcats one of Illinois' finest women's teams. Finally, the Bloomington squad has gained full use of the O'Neill Park field for all its home games.
The most successful women's semi-professional team locally, of course, are the Lady Hearts, but the Bloomington Bearcats are in many ways kind of a precursor. They were the trailblazers for the success to come.
All this adds up to an organization on the move, and Coach Johnson says the girls couldn't be more deserving. This is a fine-looking bunch of girls. They're ladies on and off the field.
Dorothy Siebert really played kind of a role in shepherding interest among young women in Bloomington Normal to play the game of softball, like she was doing, like she was able to do.
Our opponents respect us, not only for the way we play, but also for our attitude.
Our series, McHistory, is a co-production of WGLT and the McLean County Museum of History. You heard Julie Emig and Bill Kemp from the museum. WGLT's Charlie Schlenker produced this episode. And that is Sound Ideas today. WGLT's news magazine is made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm John Norton. Story help today came from WGLT's Charlie Schlenker, WCBU's Tim Shelley, and Vedette reporter Mia Saris. Ryan Tuohy edits Sound Ideas. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, part of the NPR network.